This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello, and welcome to Elgium Talks. We are about to play for you a call we held for our clients on March the 1st regarding recent developments in Ukraine and the economic and investment implications. The discussion was moderated by Mark Johnson, Head of Institutional Clients.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for joining this Elgium discussion. When we came together a few weeks ago to consider the topic of inflation, it was one of the most Google searches around. We were seeing inflation at multi-decade highs in the UK, in the European region, and in the US as the era of central bank support was coming to an end. There were questions being asked about the nature of inflation, about its persistency, about the implications for monetary policy and for asset prices. And all of this seemed like a perfectly sensible topic for a webinar. But then everything changed last week as geopolitics and inflation collided. And since last Thursday, we've all seen horror and heroism in equal measure. We've also seen a rush to safe havens, including oil, government bonds, and other assets. And all of this has really catalyzed the debate around inflation. And so today we're going to try and cover both of those topics and to try to draw out some of the themes that we see emerging, some of the implications of the conflict in Europe for the long term, and importantly, consider what investors might do as a consequence of these inflationary pressures. We're going to talk for about 30 minutes. We're then going to invite you to put your questions to the panel. And we're going to kick off, if I may, with Tim Drayson, who's our head of economics, to give us just his short perspective on the outlook and the policy response to date. So, Tim, over to you, if I may.
Thank you, Mark, and good morning, everyone. So, as Mark said, I'll focus on the global growth and inflation implications of this crisis and what it means for monetary policy. Let me start with a caveat. Economic forecasting is hard, even without the fog of war. What we know so far is that the sanctions on Russia are becoming increasingly severe, and Western companies are pulling out of Russia voluntarily with increasing momentum. So this makes a deep recession in Russia likely, I mean, possibly even a financial crisis in Russia. But Russia is a small share of the world economy, roughly 1 to 2% in cash terms, depending on which year you take your measurement. But we also know that outside of energy and some commodities, the direct trade and financial linkages with Russia and the rest of the world are relatively small, and they've shrunk considerably since the 2014 annexation of Crimea. There could be some unintended consequences, and we're watching carefully for these, but so far, signs of stress in markets have been relatively limited. So the big question is, will energy continue to flow? Disruption to energy supplies is the major downside growth risk for the world economy. So far, the supply has continued, and that's probably why crude oil prices are only modestly higher. In terms of natural gas, though, these are different markets from crude oil. They're quite separate as well across the world. So European natural gas prices have been more affected, and they've been incredibly volatile after rising several fold within the last 12 months. So I think this does make Europe more vulnerable to the US, which has its own gas supply. But if there are no kind of further disruptions, global growth will probably only be a few tenths lower as a result of the crisis. There could be some modest hit to confidence, but this is against a backdrop what would otherwise have been a strong year for global growth as a service sector rebounds from hopefully the now fading pandemic. However, you know, major disruptions could lead to dramatic energy price spikes, and that could potentially be a catalyst for recession, especially in Europe, which is most at risk. So what about inflation? Well, taking a step back, historically, wars tend to be inflationary. And in this conflict, we can see three main channels. The most immediate is this energy effect we've been discussing. So already high headline inflation is receiving a further boost from the rise in higher energy prices. But second and a bit more medium term is this conflict is adding to the trends for deglobalizations. So supply chains will be brought closer to home to improve resiliency, even if they're ultimately less efficient. And then finally, the long-term decline in developed economy defense spending is now in the course of being reversed. Indeed, we're seeing Germany as the most high-profile example with their renewed commitment to meet NATO spending numbers around 2% of GDP. That takes me on to my final kind of topic before I hand back to Mark, and that is how will central banks respond to this combination of higher inflation and weaker growth? Now, over the last couple of decades, the reaction from central banks to heightened geopolitical uncertainty has to be more accommodative. And the logic ran as follows. So higher energy prices tended to squeeze real household incomes, which in turn reduced consumer spending. And then the uncertainty would delay business investments, with both effects reducing demand and ultimately cooling inflation. And indeed, the initial market reaction to this conflict has been to reduce interest rate, increase expectations, which were priced into markets just a week or so ago. But the main difference this time is that inflation is already uncomfortably high and we're seeing tight labour markets and wage pressures. So I think this makes the job for central banks that much harder and they'll be more reluctant to back off to what is largely a negative supply shock. And the risk here is that a further rise in headline inflation de-anchors inflation expectations and acts as a catalyst for a wage price spiral. Now, without wishing to draw too many parallels, this was the dynamic of the 1970s in response to the oil price shocks. So, you know, forecasting inflation is notoriously difficult, and you will hear more about this challenge from the later speakers today. Back to you, Mark.
Thanks, Tim. So we've noted that there has been a flight to quality, a flight to safety. We've seen demand for sovereigns increasing in the developing world, but we've also seen spreads widening in emerging markets. And extraordinarily, this morning, we also saw news that the Ukrainian government is considering the issuance of a war bond. And I thought it'd be interesting to hear now from Colin Reedy, who is our head of active fixed income and active equity strategies, on what he's seeing in the fixed income space, and importantly, how are we positioned amidst all of this? Colin.
Mark, thank you, and good morning, everybody. Yes, I guess if there ever was a sign of the times, then that has to be it. This is just live this morning. We believe they're planning for today, but we await further details. I think it's a one-year local currency bond to be priced at auction. My understanding is these things are largely local bank affairs, but I guess you could see some foreign interest given how cheap it'll have to come. Yeah, I mean, things have moved as fast as always seems to be the case these days, and I obviously have no edge on what Putin may do, but fixed income markets have been relatively orderly so far, away from the directly affected areas, obviously, where price action has been pretty severe. Risk-free government bonds, as you mentioned, have benefited from that safe haven status, although not by nearly as much as you might expect, given the backdrop. And that's entirely down to the market's focus on the subject matter of today's call on being inflation. Credit spreads have widened by varying degrees, but this was already underway before the Russia-Ukraine situation. I think it's important to mention that. We now find ourselves at valuation levels that are much more interesting, what we refer to as non-recessionary wides. That is, if geopolitical events don't deliver a European or broader recession with a deterioration in the situation, then euro spreads, investment grade in particular, have seldom traded much wider than this in the last sort of 7-8 years. So I keep using the term relatively orderly, and I think this is what gets me most nervous. One of the lessons we thought we'd learned from the pandemic was that human beings are rubbish at pricing exponential risk. COVID in its infancy was a local affair playing out a long way from home and wasn't going to be an issue for most of us, and how wrong we were. We now have another example of this behaviour, and it would appear that lessons weren't well learned, if at all. More as an interesting observation, I think worthy of mention is, in my experience, this is the first significant military conflict playing out in the full glare of social media. My 16-year-old daughter has never been interested in a major geopolitical event before, but is fully engaged in watching this all on TikTok. So I wouldn't underestimate the impact this has had on how quickly the West has discovered its collective resolve. For example, politicians are incredibly responsive to social media these days, rightly or wrongly. And, you know, looking back in history, the Iraq War was exactly this time in 2003, but Facebook wasn't launched until 2004 and Twitter 2006. So there was no social media back then. On the inflation topic, as Tim has mentioned, you know, assuming the fighting doesn't spread outside Ukraine, then the principal way this is going to affect markets is via higher energy prices. If it is a short-lived spike in energy prices, then we don't think much will have changed for the Fed, and they can get back on the tack of rate increases in following meetings. ECB is obviously far, far closer to the action, and is not as far behind the curve as the Fed, so it's got the luxury of being able to wait without denting credibility, and we're already seeing the front end of markets price that likelihood. I will pause there, Mark, and hand back to yourself.
Thanks, Colin. So, as promised, we wanted to delve a little deeper into the concept of inflation, and hearing some of the remarks from Tim and Colin, it feels like we're back in the 1980s with Thatcher and Volcker talking incessantly about ways to control inflation, but the reality is that it is creeping up, and we do need to think about our investment strategy as a result of that. So I'd like to bring in, if I may, Chris Jeffrey, our head of rates and inflation, just to give us his thoughts in terms of how we might approach this question from an investment point of view. Chris.
Yeah, hi, thanks, Mark. I want to stand back actually a little bit from the conflagration in Ukraine to just think about the inflation process a bit more broadly, and how this latest shock is just an example of several that kind of can tell us something about what we should do here as investors. So the example of several is that shocks by their nature are unanticipated. And the unanticipated shocks have a nasty habit of pushing inflation forecasts miles away from where they were previously. So we can look at the front end of inflation curves over the last 6 months and see the ratcheting higher in expectations. So just the UK numbers, the peak in RPI priced in has gone from 5% 6 months ago to 10% now is the priced in peak. Or we can stand back even further and just look at the terrible inflation forecasting track record of monetary authorities over the last 15 years. The Bank of England's numbers, not trying to particularly knock them, but just want to point out that there's been a negative correlation between forecasts and realized outcomes over the last 16 years. And that's despite, as an institution, them spending £37 million per annum on monetary analysis. The other issue with, I guess, any debate around inflation is how quickly it reduces to two people standing on a street corner, one of them saying we're doomed to repeat the mistakes of the 1970s, and one of them saying we're doomed to repeat the mistakes of Japan. So that becomes quite a sort of unsatisfying basis for any kind of investment proposition when you have people arguing about such small samples. Our message here is that rather than trying to pretend that we know more than we do, because nobody on this call is going to pretend to know what is likely to happen to natural gas prices over the next few months, and that will be the number one determinant of European inflation, that we should embrace that uncertainty and take that mindset forwards into how we think about asset allocation and investments.
Yeah, I think that's right. So just following up from what Chris said, we just need to remain humble and be very careful about building narratives that can lead to false confidence. And so instead of that, try and make use of historical periods where sample sizes are large enough. So, for example, central bank hiking cycles and their impacts on assets. And then to focus more on preparing rather than predicting. So rather than spending too much time on a single central scenario, looking at that whole landscape, because in reality, when you map it, the likelihood of even your central scenario is generally 30% or below. So spending too much time on that one idea can actually be a mistake.
John, I'm going to introduce you formally because you've just added to what Chris was saying. So John Rowe, who is our head of multi-asset funds. John, you know, one of the debates that we've been having internally and was much written about in the media was whether this concept was transitory or permanent. And I think you might feel that that's probably the wrong question to ask.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's exactly the kind of narrative we have to be very careful not to waste time on. First of all, because it's too long term. And secondly, because central banks will react anyway. So instead of that, we think we need to look at three pairs of concepts that we can actually have more of an idea about. So the first of those is to do with, what are we worried about? Should we be more worried about local inflation, or should we be more worried about global inflation that affects all asset prices? And for diversified investors, we would often be more concerned about the second of those. Then secondly, we need to think about what central banks believe is necessary to control inflation. So the idea of controllable versus uncontrollable inflation, regardless of whether or not they're right, and the action that might lead to and what that will mean for asset prices. And then finally, we need to recognize that there are two types of inflation concerns. The first is protection from shocks in the short term, like commodity price spikes, as others have mentioned. And the second is hedging the risk of a prolonged period of inflation, which can then have longer term implications for a wider range of assets.
Okay, thanks, John. I'd like to bring Laura in at this point. So Laura is responsible for client solutions. Laura, just your thoughts on the last of those, really, in terms of protecting versus hedging and what clients might do as a result of the inflationary pressures that we're seeing.
Thank you, Mark. So I think it's very easy, as we've said already, to get distracted when thinking about investment strategy by trying to predict the outcome, or, you know, very understandably, worrying a lot about short-term events. In a time of crisis, it can clearly be very stressful. And with investment strategy, as with life, in reality, the time horizons for most of us are lengthy. So I tend to think about the ABC framework, which I also use in stressful situations with my children, which is firstly to accept what's happened, to breathe, and then to choose. And much of the time, from a strategic perspective, you'll be choosing to do nothing. And that's the right answer. So while it may not be the best time to be doing things from a long-term strategy perspective, a time of crisis is as good as a time as any to reflect on long-term strategy, to think about preparing rather than predicting, as we've said. And having a plan in place really helps you position to capture whatever opportunities come along as the situation evolves. So, for example, the recent move up in investment grade credit spreads that Colin mentioned. Inflation is really helpful to us at the moment, I think, in terms of providing a fresh lens for us to view some of the perennial investment strategy topics and, you know, test out our thoughts on whether the strategy is really robust enough to deal with those. So things like diversification, duration, the pace of any planned asset allocation changes. And then, as you noted, hedging and protection strategies, of course, are a key part of what the thinking should be.
Okay, thanks, Laura. So I just want to go back to what John was noting earlier, the idea that there are effectively three pairs of concepts when you're looking at inflation. And the first of those, I think, was whether this is a local or a global phenomenon.
So what I'd say here is that there's a very big difference in principle and both in practice, repeatedly, in terms of the dynamics that impact portfolios as a function of whether the inflationary experience is idiosyncratic to the base currency of your portfolio or whether it's global in nature. If it's idiosyncratic to the base currency of your portfolio, then there's going to be very strong currency implications. If not, then you don't need to worry about that channel of transmission so much. When thinking about the current shock, clearly there's a global story overlaid with a regional story, as Tim outlined at the beginning of the call. But I want to kind of pull out a couple of different areas of differentiation that I think are underappreciated. So the first is that I'm sure most people on this call are very familiar with the story in the West, inflation high and rising to uncomfortable levels. But they're probably less familiar with the fact that Chinese inflation is treading water at just below 1%. Now, that has created interesting dynamics in Chinese fixed income markets, where government bond yields have fallen 50 basis points in the last 12 months, and currency markets, where the RMB has been up something like 8% in the last 12 months. So if you've been looking for a port in the inflation storm,
over the last 12 months, it's been in China. Now, the point here is saying going forwards, which country is likely to be that port is quite hard, but it really does kind of emphasize the importance of global diversification when dealing with these kind of shocks.
Yeah, so I think, and then when we think about the investment implications, they're obviously very different. I mean, domestic inflation in some ways is quite hard to protect from the actual shocks of it. Because if you go, for example, for inflation-linked securities, you get problems around, they really only protect you from a longer-term shock, a kind of prolonged change in expectations. So I think one of the things to always bear in mind is the role of currency, particularly in the case of bigger shocks. So some countries have long and glorious histories of higher inflation than their targets, and the UK is one such example of that. And so historically has missed its targets on a repeated basis, and that's put downward pressure on the currencies. And then secondly, you've got what actually happens in risk-off environments. So actually a weaker FX, if you get a global shock, you can actually end up with some currencies end up weaker. And when they do, those countries import inflation, which actually then creates a bigger problem. And again, the pound's a good example of that, where it tends to perform poorly in risk-off environments. And so actually owning overseas currencies is quite a good risk mitigant. Whereas if you take a different base currency, so a Japanese investor, actually with the yen tending to strengthen in extreme risk-off periods, then actually they tend to import deflation and the inflation problem gets less bad. And actually owning overseas currencies is kind of less helpful for them in that environment. So it's kind of worth thinking about what can actually do domestically, and currency, the amount of overseas currency tends to be a really important driver. And then secondly, for global shocks, so getting away from the domestic, it really just highlights when you've got that level of uncertainty, you just need to be super diversified. So we call it the concentration conundrum. So if you look within equities this year, the UK is about -2%, Europe's about -11%, reflecting the different composition of these indices. Commodity returns are 15% and gold's +5%. Meanwhile, within investment grade, you've got real underperformance of euro investment grade, as Colin mentioned. And so when you put all of that together, it's just a real reminder to stay super diversified when you've got this level of uncertainty over inflation, because it can lead to quite sudden and unexpected changes in relative performance. And if you have those concentrations, it can lead to the risk of more adverse outcomes if you happen to be in the wrong place.
So I think our message here is probably coming through loud and clear that global diversification is key. And I guess many clients listening will, of course, have this as a core part of their strategy. But from our perspective, it's always worth revisiting and considering opportunities perhaps to extend or embrace wider diversification beyond traditional markets, especially on the fixed income side and the real asset side, where we know investors have generally acted a little more cautiously in going global than on equities. ETFs can really help here in terms of rapid access to non-traditional markets, for example, Indian or Chinese bonds. In addition, currency hedging, we've sort of touched on this in various ways, but the strategic role of currency hedging, I think, is really underplayed in many strategies. It's a bit of an unloved part of the world, perhaps doesn't get as much discussion as other hedging strategies might. So as the guys have said, it's really worth considering in particular how currency hedging at the strategic level can reduce or increase your risk overall and help or hinder in relation to inflation in particular, depending on your domestic market. So now's a good time to prepare for what might lie ahead by giving a bit more love and care to that question. And of course, changes to your currency hedging can be made very rapidly. Many of our clients use overlays to do this, so you don't have to go looking at all of your individual mandates. You can take a sort of higher level decision to implement something across the board.
Thanks, Laura. Can we just look for a second at what central banks might do in response? So I think we've understood that inflation is here. It's back with a vengeance, and there are only so many tools in the toolkit.
Yeah, so I mean, the thing we're trying to draw out with this controllable versus uncontrollable kind of sleeve in the middle is that central banks firmly believe that they hold a hammer and that inflation is a nail and that they can control it. And the thing that gives them that comfort is a principle which is hardwired into pretty much every one of their frameworks, that if you want to drive down inflation and inflation expectations, you need to drive up real interest rates. That is their control mechanism. Now, that control mechanism does imply kind of quite uncomfortable things. It implies that the mechanism, which has in some ways been supporting all asset classes over the last
5 to 6 years of lower real interest rates cannot be relied upon as much going forwards. It implies that the correlation between equities and bonds, which has been persistently negative for about the last 20 years, has actually been very close to zero over the course of the last 12 months. We've got a slide on that, just sort of showing that lack of bond protection coming through when equities are particularly weak. And you've got to kind of think about, well, what's the right response to that? Is the right response to that to be reducing duration strategically? We think the answer to that is yes, and that's something that we've done as part of our strategic asset allocation overview in the last 12 months. But we don't think the answer to that is just to throw out the government bond, government bonds as an asset class. So I mentioned earlier that we have very small samples when thinking about inflationary episodes. We have quite a lot of evidence of what happens with various asset classes during recessionary episodes. In fact, we've had 12 US recessions since World War II. They're ugly. I mean, they're really ugly for both equities and investment grade credit. So something like 20% of equities on average, 80 basis points wider on IG credit spreads. But 12 out of 12 times, and that's a pretty good hit ratio by anybody's metric, we've seen government bond yields fall. Now, that recession hedge is worth having. And I think if there's kind of one message that I'd kind of leave this section on, is that you've got to be very, very careful about not focusing all of your attention on the kind of inflation risk and then throwing out all of your other portfolio construction principles. But I'm going to hand over to John.
Yeah, I think just quickly before I move on to broad implications, I think that point on the equity bond correlation is one of the most important ones because it's so central implicitly to how a lot of risk models work. So it's a lot of people got so comfortable with it because it's worked so well over a period of 5 to 10 years. And so strategies that rely on it have worked really well over a period of 5 to 10 years. And therefore it can create a sense of comfort. And when you have a potential regime shift, which is what we might be looking at because of higher inflation, that kind of can really bring into question the starting point for a lot of portfolio construction ideas. So if you think about what the rate hikes and what Chris talked about, this mechanism for controlling inflation might mean for other asset classes, it tightens liquidity because it sucks out that easy money and that cheap lending. And that can have profound implications on credit spreads. If you look at where we went into 2022, spreads were pretty much the closest, the lowest they've been in 15 years. So very little offered in terms of liquidity premium. As Colin mentioned, that has blown out a fair way now. So that might start to offer more value. But still at the same time, we know that if the equities, the inflation remains prolonged, real assets like equities or infrastructure, global real estate can offer more protection in terms of their earnings tend to go up as inflation is realized. And that provides more of that protection. So it tends to lead to a preference for equities and other real assets over credit.
Laura, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I was just going to add to that, really, that I think if you're already in the process of making strategy changes, it's worth considering how things are looking, whether there's an opportunity to accelerate if market levels are in the place that you want them to be, or alternatively to think about averaging into new positions, depending on which way you're going, to avoid the downside risk from choosing the wrong day in volatile times. It's a classic case of preparing and not predicting. So just thinking through what you're trying to achieve and setting your strategy around that asset allocation shift suitably. On the credit side, picking up on some of what's been said about sort of shorter dated and floating rate credit, that's certainly where we're seeing a bit of a pickup in interest from our clients, which I would expect to continue in the light of the inflationary pressures. So examples like short dated private credit opportunities and things like trade receivables, fund financing, where you have this opportunity to harvest the illiquidity and complexity premium for some really nice spread, but without coming under pressure on the duration side, as it's very, very short dated. And similarly, absolute return bond strategies that seem to be of interest on the fixed income side.
Thanks, Laura. I think before we go to questions, in fact, I can sort of roll one of the questions into this next point, really, which is about different types of inflation risk. So we've talked about sort of the short term versus the longer term and the types of assets that might protect against either of those. And one of the questions that's come in is, you know, what do we think might outperform inflation in 2022? Chris, do you want to kick off and then perhaps ask John to add to that?
Yeah, sure. So I think we just make the distinction between assets which help you in the event of an inflation shock and assets which help you preserve purchasing power over time in the long run. And they may not be the same thing. It sounds like sort of at face value that an inflation protecting asset is an inflation protecting asset, but that's really not the dynamics that we've seen historically. If you're looking for an asset which will do well if inflation continues to surprise on the upside in the next 12 months, then it's really hard to look much further than commodities. They're the asset which has typically had the highest correlation with short-term inflation surprises. But over the long term, we've got to be aware that commodities have some of the worst risk-adjusted real returns of any asset class that is investable to mainstream investors. So you're kind of trading off something that will help protect you against inflation shocks in the near term, something that is likely to do a much less impressive job at preserving purchasing power over the long term. If you're caring about that preserving purchasing power over the long term, then as John's already kind of touched on it, it's the real assets generating real cash flows which have inflation linkage implicit or explicit within them. But rather than kind of parrot John's phrases, maybe I'll pass directly to him, see what else he's got to say.
Yeah, I think just because we've been through a period of such benign inflation, people forget that the importance of that big split to some degree between nominal and inflation-linked assets. And it also means that some of the things that have worked really well over the last 6 or 7 years, which has been to a degree reversion to mean, has worked really well. You kind of, something does well, you kind of sell a bit, and if something does badly, you buy a bit. It's kind of worked well because we haven't been through any kind of bigger shocks outside of the initial COVID experience. But actually, when you get into prolonged periods of inflation, then actually the danger is you slip back to that strategy of thinking, oh, well, that's over now, I don't need to worry about it. Whereas actually, if we do get a period where central banks are wrong in their ability to manage inflation, or concerns over global financing conditions, conflict, whatever else, mean they're slower to hike rates than they otherwise would be, then we do have this risk of sustained inflation risk. And in that environment, then actually some of the kind of buying into things that give you that longer term protection, be it infrastructure, etc., can be very beneficial, as can for those strategies that are able to kind of alternative strategies. So strategies that actually benefit from when realized worse paths happen. So actually kind of long volatility strategies where actually you benefit as volatility continues to pick up, or trend following. So one of the natural things after a period where reversion to mean has worked well, so you've got a lot of value investors that tend to buy more on small sell-offs and that sort of thing. And actually trend following, a more mechanistic approach that says, actually, if things start to go badly, I will continue with that. I will actually buy into the idea that things might continue to do badly, can be kind of very beneficial because it helps fight some of those behavioral biases where we've all got used to buy the dip, et cetera, and it can help in larger drawdowns.
It's an interesting one in terms of the sort of speed of accessing different types of strategies. So John and Chris touched there on real assets. Clearly, the shift into private markets, renewables, etc., is going to continue. It's not a short-term fix, but of course, we see the attractions of having inflation-linked cash flows alongside really strong ESG credentials as well. So getting that plan in place, preparing to move in that direction is absolutely fundamental for a lot of our clients at the moment. On the more rapid side, and for those that are interested, despite the health warnings that Chris gave us, it is possible to get rapid access to commodities, a range of strategies via ETFs. And then where equities are favoured for the long-term inflation protection that they clearly give us over the very long run, but there's less tolerance for short-term volatility and drawdowns, we've seen interest in protected equity strategies. So options pricing actually looks, for some people, surprisingly attractive for certain structures, despite or indeed because of the volatility. And that can help some clients maintain exposure over the long run to the upside from equities, but smooth out some of the more extreme downside risk over time. And that's a theme that is captured in many of our multi-asset funds and also available to investors on a standalone basis in pooled funds. So definitely something to think about if that kind of volatility is a concern.
Thanks. Thanks, Laura. We're going to just jump to some questions. Thanks to everybody that's been sending them in. And I'm going to kick off with one that is almost benign, given the current news flow, which is about Brexit. I never thought I'd say that. But just wondering, maybe, Tim, just your thoughts on whether there is any, I suppose, legacy impact on inflation from Brexit. If you sort of strip out energy prices, are we seeing a Brexit effect as well playing a part here?
I think we are in the UK economy in terms of the tight labour market. So a lot of labour supply left after Brexit and with the pandemic, and it hasn't come back. So we're seeing signs of wage pressures building, and this is beginning to feed through into higher core inflation alongside the energy price shock, which unfortunately for the UK consumer is still largely ahead. And as Chris has pointed out, break-even price is going to have a particularly high print for RPI over the next few months. So, you know, sadly, the legacy of Brexit is to reduce potential growth and raise inflation pressure.
Thanks, Tim. And then another question, maybe for John or for Chris, about linkers. We haven't said much about linkers, but just the role of linkers in a portfolio and whether we think that they are risky or risk-free in some way.
I think the main place for linkers in portfolios is specifically for those clients. If you talk about UK linkers, it's specifically those with inflation-linked UK liabilities. They offer unbelievably poor value because there's a kind of captive market of buyers, but the reality is that, you know, people need to buy them because they need to match that risk because they don't want to take it. I think if you think about global inflation linked government bonds, then there's kind of a clearer role, which is that, you know, we've still got inflation priced around central bank targets over outside the UK, around central bank targets over the longer term. And if we did break out into a more inflationary regime, a longer term, more corrosive environment, then these are the types of assets that can be very helpful. They don't provide particularly good protection against short term inflation. And the reason for that is this control mechanism that Chris outlined, which is that if you get inflation, it can cause central banks to react. They generally will react. And when they react, it can then drive down future inflation, which is what you're actually primarily exposed to in inflation-linked government bonds. So you need to be a little bit careful. They work well for corrosive long-term inflation. They arguably work a lot less well for inflation shocks because of those central banks coming in to control it with extra rate hikes.
We've had a very nice theoretical question come in around the role of monetarism and whether it's dead. The question is whether the huge injection of cash we've seen from QE is going to fuel inflation. And I suspect the answer to that is yes. But is monetarism dead? I don't know if anyone's got a view on that, Tim or John.
Maybe I'll kick off and then Chris and John can follow up. Monetarism's making a bit of a comeback. We've seen strong money supply growth now across a lot of the developed economies. And this does seem to have coincided with this pickup in headline inflation. I think the interesting question is what will happen to money supply when central banks start with their quantitative tightening? And the Fed has indicated this will occur after one or two rate hikes. It's already begun in the UK. So the behaviour of the banks in terms of extending credit will be critical to see whether or not that withdrawal of cash kind of gets the money supply numbers down and helps contain inflation. But let's see what Chris or John has to say as well on the topic.
So the easy phrase to kind of roll out at this point is that inflation is created when you've got too much money chasing too few goods. Over the last 12 months, we've both seen too much money because of the QE expansion, and we've seen too few goods because of the supply chain disruptions. I guess we don't know how the second of those is going to evolve over the course of the next year. The optimists on this front would argue that supply chain disruptions become less acute as we roll through time and move further away from the pandemic. But it just remains an open question. So I think it's sort of been ambiguous over the last 12 months, which of those has been in the driving seat and driving inflation higher. And I guess that's sort of the crux of the transitory versus persistent debate that this call has been talking about at the outset. So I think it's really, really hard to say whether that
as the money supply provided by central banks is reduced, it will have the impact that we want to see. I think it's really one of those kind of central sort of unknowable questions, which is why we think that transitory versus permanent framework is probably just not the most fruitful way to be thinking about analysing this issue.
Thanks, Chris. Well, if we don't have any more questions, I'd like just to ask John, if you can, just to try and pull this together in terms of your conclusions.
I think our key message is prepare, don't predict. Be very careful of being caught up in any particular narrative around the direction of inflation and exactly what it means. We've seen again in the last 24 hours with investors effectively guessing that central banks will pivot, and actually, despite more inflation pressure because of higher commodity prices, there'll actually be less rate hikes. Kind of shows just how easy it is to buy into one narrative and for the market to go the other way in the end. So it would be more kind of prepare, don't predict, and as a result, take a range of measures of the type we've discussed today so that you're not too exposed to any one scenario, because often it's about getting through periods of volatility that's without the needing to de-risk, for example, that helps us get the long-term growth that we're looking for as investors.
Well, thank you, John, and thanks to our panel.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, elgim.com. Copyright 2021, Legal and General Investment Management Limited. All rights reserved. No part of this publication may be reproduced or transmitted in any form or by any means, including photocopying and recording, without the written permission of the publishers. This material is issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, a licensed corporation, BBB 488, regulated by the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission, for professional investors only.